In this episode of Nightmare Echoes, Eleazar and Jesse cover the 1978 John Carpenter film Halloween, as well as the 1977 Argento film Suspiria and its re-envisioned 2018 remake of the same name. But since we love to speak about horror movies, we also mention Friday the 13th, Scream, Psycho, Nightmare on Elm Street, the 1978 Dawn of the Dead, X, Pearl, as well as the entire Halloween franchise. So naturally, spoilers ahead. With that being said, I wanted to add, while recording these two segments, we were so excited to talk about the movies that we really forgot to walk through the plot at all. So hopefully you've seen the movies, or if you haven't, you want to go see them now, but we're about to spoil the whole thing. In John Carpenter's Halloween, a little boy named Michael kills his older sister and is institutionalized. Years later, when he is an adult, he breaks out and goes on a murder spree targeting babysitters in the town of Houghtonville, Illinois. On the chase is the doctor who cared for him for the last 15 years, Dr. Samuel Loomis. The 1977 Dario Argento film Suspiria arguably has no plot, or is at least not plot-heavy. An American ballet student joins a prestigious dance academy in Germany, and people start dying around her. And what she doesn't know is the school was founded decades ago by a famous witch and is now controlled by a coven whose motivations are wealth and power. Thank you for letting me ramble on a bit, but one more detail is that next week I'm bringing Steven back to the podcast to cover Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. You might have listened to him in a previous episode cover Rob Zombie's Halloween 1. That episode is called Chucky's a Sheriff. So next week we have Chucky's a Sheriff Part 2, where we'll be covering the second movie that came out in 2009. So hopefully looking forward to that. All right, enjoy the episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Nightmare Echoes podcast. I'm your host, Eleazar. I'm joined again by co-host Jesse. Jesse, how's it going?
Pretty good.
All right, what are we covering today, Jesse?
I believe we're covering Halloween 1978.
I love this one. It's starring Donald Pleasence as Dr. Loomis, Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie, Tony Moran as Michael Myers, and of course directed by John Carpenter, which I love. He did movies like The Thing and The Fog.
The Thing and other things.
The Thing and other things, completely. Starting off the movie here, it starts Halloween night, 1963. We get the title card that says Halloween, and we get the Halloween theme music. You had comments on the theme music you want to talk about?
Oh, boy. Do I have comments on the theme music?
Is it simple for you? Is that what it is?
I am not a fan of the theme music.
Really?
I've got to say.
I might be the first person in history I've heard say that.
I'm well aware of that, but I just... Well, first of all, it is very simple.
Okay, that's where I thought you were going to go with it.
But then it is very repetitive, and it is repeated seemingly without any variation through much of the movie, regardless of the tone of the scene or anything. And it's like there'll be casual conversation walking down the street, and it's clearly supposed to be, this is the happy mood, and it's still that little do-do-do-do, that same little three notes over and over, and it's just monotonous and doesn't work.
What's funny is that because like half of his career is his music. People are like, we need to get John Carpenter on this movie. We can't do this movie without John Carpenter. So many people, and
that's crazy because while I was listening to it, I'm like, this is, the score is so bad. There's no way this is a professional composer. And then I looked it up. I'm like, yeah, the director did it himself. No wonder. That's why it sucks.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, it's iconic. I mean, it's in history as iconic.
I am so well aware of that. I'm just telling you, I have a different opinion.
That's fine. Okay, interesting. It zooms in on the pumpkin. The pumpkin, when it zooms in, is supposed to be the shape of Michael Myers holding the knife, like the left eyeball, and the nose is, when you go in, it's the shape.
I see.
Which is interesting. Our first scene, we get two teens making out on a couch. It's Michael's older sister and her boyfriend. They leave to go up the stairs. In about 1.5 minutes, the boyfriend's already finished what he went up there to do, which might be what saved his life. He leaves the picture. Michael grabs a knife. He's wearing a clown costume. He goes up there, sees his sister brushing her hair topless, which I guess is a thing. He stabs her repeatedly. It's supposed to be very phallic, I think, the knife going into the body. But that may be all slashers that see that way. But he kills his sister, walks outside with the clown costume on. His parents drive up, see him. They're like, Michael, what is it? He's holding this massive knife with blood in it. The camera crane zooms out. The parents don't move. They don't take the knife away from him. Nothing happens. And that's the end of that scene. Then it cuts. It's 15 years later.
Yeah, and you were mentioning that you don't understand why, like, the parents didn't at least take the knife away from him, right? And I was saying, like, you know, it kind of seems like maybe the bad parenting is part of the reason that he wound up the way he did, right?
Right. And then, which they do cover in Rob Zombie's Halloween films that come later. Rob Zombie originally wanted to do a two-parter, with the first part being exploring Michael Myers as a kid, and the second part being Michael Myers as an adult, but the Weinsteins didn't want that. After, I guess, commercial failure that was Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, they wanted a new take and they wanted to go a different direction, so they didn't want to go that different. So they let him make the first half of the first movie, Michael Myers as a Child, which really explored it. I think it was a lot of fun. His family is, in that world, is an a-hole family. Like, everybody in that family is just rude, jerks, foul mouths. Maybe not everybody, but for the most part. And then his school life sucks as well. So it's interesting.
It's funny, because I've watched a lot of these true crime documentaries on YouTube and stuff, and it seems like it's a lot of the time it's more the opposite. Like these kids who you know, wind up murdering people, that it's like a lot of them seem to come from this family that's like, oh, we always give him whatever he wants and we've never denied him anything. I don't know why he's so, you know, the way he is. And it's like, well, maybe that's what it is, right?
Someone finally told them no.
Right. He's gotten used to never being told no, and then someone tells them no and they're like, how dare you, you know, how dare you tell me no, right?
Right, exactly. What I found interesting in my research about this scene is that this scene is the last thing they filmed, that the way the house looks in the rest of the movie is the way the house really was. It was a tore down, abandoned house, broken windows, walls falling apart, and the entire crew and cast, even Jamie Lee Curtis herself, was whitewashing walls and then hanging up curtains and putting up furniture, and only in the areas of the house that these shots were going to happen. So,
makes sense.
They just made it look pretty for that moment, and in this shot, which is, it's really three different takes, but it's filmed to make it look like it's a one take the whole time. There's like two cuts in the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Camera crew are like ducking out of the way, but do see like a shadow of a camera if you're really looking, which is...
I noticed this, and this throughout this movie, I noticed there was really good camera work. I definitely distinctly noticed that. There were a lot of long shots that I thought were really interesting. Like in particular, later on, there's a scene where you see from inside the backseat of the car as the car's going around the corner. Okay. Oh, that's so good.
Interesting about that scene is they got to towards the end of the movie and they were short on minutes. And so he got Laurie Strode and the woman who played Annie back in, and they're like, let's just film it from the back seat.
Well, I'm glad they did, because I think it really enhanced that part of the movie, added to the tension.
Right. And also it served as a way to get to the nighttime, because when they leave her dad from the store that was robbed, that Michael Myers broke into, it was full daytime. And when they get to the house, it's dark. So this scene, slowly getting darker, and they actually used a camera trick to dim the footage to make it look like it was transitioning dark. So then we jump to where they're getting ready to babysit. It's now nighttime, and they didn't have that scene before.
I see.
But yeah, there was a lot of really interesting long takes. Like, I watched the commentary with John Carpenter and Jamie Lee Curtis, and she is fascinated how movies today won't do that. But when we're building up the tension in the movie, there'll be a scene where Jamie Lee Curtis is looking up the stairs for maybe 5 to 10 seconds without moving. And she's like, that kind of thing wouldn't work in a movie nowadays. Like, people won't do it. But it is really cool, like, how the cameras work with that. It's October 30th, 1978. It's Smith Grove, Illinois. It's their it's the facility that Michael's staying at. And when Dr. Loomis and Nurse Chambers drive up to there, all the inmates are out and about running wild, which I don't know if this is like a nighttime hobby thing that they do, you know. Dr. Loomis is talking about how Michael hasn't spoken a word in 15 years. They say they're going to transfer him. They're probably going to give him Thorazine when they do it, but I think they have to transfer him because the law has said that he has to move to a different facility.
Yeah, and speaking of that guy, I wanted to say, like, I know he's supposed to be some sort of famous actor, but like, I felt like he was really kind of hamming it up, and he was like the only actor there that I didn't really like, because I felt like he overdid his part. And I think that's a lot of those old stage actors whose careers go way back. They have a more hammy style of acting that's more rooted in the past, and to me, I don't like that style of acting. I like the more realistic.
Yeah, they're probably used to projecting.
Right.
Like, they have to be like, the audience must hear me.
Yeah, and they have to exaggerate the emotion in their voice too.
Right. Exactly.
And I think I liked most of the acting in the movie, but his not as much for that reason.
I getcha. Yeah. I think the only one that stuck with it the longest, because Jamie Lee Curtis was in 1 and 2. 3 was a different story, a different universe. 4 continued the story with Jamie's daughter, who they eventually killed off in 6. But Donald Pleasance is in everything but 3.
Makes sense. He's the, I guess, hero in a way.
Yeah, sure. I know Jamie Lee Curtis was looking forward to working with him. And then, like, they only had 2 scenes together, so that was really interesting. In this scene, Dr. Loomis goes out, tells the Nurse Chambers to stay there, and we get this scene where Michael runs up the top of the car and he breaks the window from the side, pulls her out, and then starts driving. I know that he, you know, went, he was like, what, 8
when he went into prison or, you know, mental facility and 15 years later. But this movie has him drive a lot.
But that didn't bother me because they called attention to it.
They did. I like the way they did.
They had the scene. It was like, well, somebody must have taught him, you know, like, yeah. It's fine. I don't care.
It's something that like a lot of fans for the longest time was like, that one's silly. And like, they'll try to pretend it never happened. But
well, somebody taught him.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, the novelization like went to clear it up and said that every time he was driving with Dr. Loomis, he was studying what he was doing while driving, which...
No. It's not how you learn a skill.
No? Okay.
I don't think so.
So then he drives away, and then we get to go to Lori's house. We see her dad, you know, tells her she's got to drop off this package because he's a realtor. He's in charge of selling the Myers house. She's walking, and she runs into Tommy Doyle, who's the boy she's going to babysit at the end of the movie. He's scared of the Mexican wolfman and the boogeyman. And he thinks she's brave for going to the house, which she has no idea that Michael's in there.
Right. Well, yeah, nobody does.
Right.
It's also kind of interesting, the idea that Michael would go back to this broken down house just because it was like, you know,
his house.
You know, like that's kind of interesting.
Right. I mean, he's the embodiment of evil. He's the boogeyman. I don't know.
But I just think it's like the fact that he has a comfort zone, right? That's where he wants to be.
Yeah. Later sequels will have you. It wasn't written in this one at all. But as early as part two, we find out that Jamie Curtis's character was his little sister and that they never showed in the beginning that there was a baby in the house that whole time and that she grew up and she had no memory. She was adopted by the people who are parents now, the Strodes, and that's why Michael's after her because they're brother and sister. Okay. And it's there throughout the first 10 movies in every incarnation. That they always bring it up, and it gets erased when Halloween 2018 happened because they erased everything but the first movie, and the first movie never mentioned it.
Yeah, and he's such an interesting, like, I really like the mask.
Yeah.
You know, and the look of that, like how it renders him featureless and everything. But
do you know whose face it was?
It's supposed to be someone's face.
Yeah, that's William Shatner's face. They bought a really badly done William Shatner face mask.
To me, it just seemed formless. Like,
and they dyed it white and widened the eye holes.
It just seemed like no shape at all to me.
But I know. But isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
That there was William Shatner's face.
I'm surprised William Shatner didn't try to get some money out of him for it.
I'm sure he tried, but... I mean, he sold the rights to the mask, and then they paid the rights to use the mask. So there's not much they could have done about it, I guess.
I did like the mask and everything, but other than that, I didn't think he was that scary as a villain, because he didn't really have any special abilities other than lunging at people with knives.
And not dying. Like, he doesn't seem to die. He also, people will argue this forever. I believe he teleports. People say he doesn't. The one scene in this movie, after Lori walks home with her friends, and she goes up to her window, her window's open, she looks outside, and you see Michael under the hung-up clothes. She never breaks eye contact, and then he's just gone. She would have seen him run or walk away, but she's staring at him. He doesn't move, and as she's still staring at him, he's just not there anymore. Mm. It's the only one time I think it just doesn't work, if he's not supernatural, if he's not teleporting.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for the time, the scariest moment for me throughout the whole movie was when Jamie finds Linda's body, then she finds Bob's body, Annie, Bob, then Linda, in the bedroom where she set up like the funeral, and she exits out of the room screaming. She backs away to the door, and then Michael's in the other side. It's all black, and the light barely turns on.
Oh, yeah.
You see this mask has been there the whole time.
Yeah, there's a lot of good camera work, and like I said, the visual of the mask works. It's just conceptually, I don't know, the concept isn't that scary to me.
I get what you're saying.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like you could just get away, you know?
Yeah, but I know it's the earlier you go, the bar was lower.
Yeah.
But it like opened the stage for a lot of things. Like Friday the 13th would never have been made if this movie wasn't successful. Like the creator of it called us, Fred, and says, hey, let's copy Halloween for a movie. I have a title. I have nothing else but a title. You want to write a movie with me?
But what exactly is he copying? Like, what is the substance of Halloween that everyone was copying or was so impressed by?
I don't know if it was the type of slasher, maybe like
the type.
Like, I don't know. Gruesome kills. Well, in itself, this followed Black Christmas, which was a slasher before it. And I think I read somewhere he was like, well, let's just do a different holiday, and we can do that too. So instead of Black Christmas, we get Halloween. So, I mean, there's always people that people look back on.
It's just that red and green Halloween.
Right. There you go. That's funny. But I mean, Scream, you know, the pulled a lot from it. Like, they even honored it by showing it in the movie.
Yeah.
A lot of what they did.
I'm just trying to, like, I'm trying to get a better handle on what the character of the movie is supposed to be. What about it that was so innovative or new?
I think a killer that's not going to stop coming for you, that will just keep coming and killing for almost no reason. Like, after that, I mean, I know the first Friday the 13th was Mrs. Voorhees, but when Jason came about, it's just this killer that didn't talk. He kept coming, and he just kept killing. And those, I think a lot of slashers after this kind of had that idea.
I guess earlier movies, they were maybe, I'm trying to compare it to something to see the differences. I'm thinking, like, Psycho is an example I can think of, an earlier slasher, I guess. But
Jamie Lee Curtis is the daughter of the woman that died in Psycho.
I'm just trying to, like, I guess better understand what was novel about it. And maybe him not talking was what was special.
It could be.
Or maybe...
I mean, it's definitely parallel to, like, if you look at A Nightmare on Elm Street, like Freddy Krueger, he's just punny like crazy. Like, it's prime time, bitch, and throws a woman into a TV screen.
Yeah.
Kills a dog and is like, I was just trying to pet him. Like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so it's like kind of the opposite.
Yeah. One of the problems I had, so I haven't actually said this out loud. I'll say that. I didn't really like it that much.
Okay.
I wasn't very impressed. I didn't think it was very good, in my opinion, by my personal standards. Maybe I'm a heathen.
It could be, yeah.
But like, I do feel like I said, I didn't like the music. The premise wasn't that scary to me. And I just felt like the movie was a very plain movie. Like, it was just, you've just got a guy. He's just stabbing people. That's kind of it.
He's shot 6 times and walks away.
Well, that actually bothered me too. Because I'm like, oh my God. You know, like, that, it just seemed like so ridiculous.
He teleported away.
Like, I don't know. It did not strike me in a way that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the opposite. I love this movie. I love that it brought me a franchise that is 13 movies long with 5 different timelines. I think the most confusing horror franchise that I follow.
Well, okay, but the franchise is divorced from the first movie
this,
by itself.
Yeah, but I would say that this might be the best of it.
Interesting.
I mean, I like it a lot. Yeah, I enjoy this one a lot. I like the characters. I guess I cared about the characters in this. I cared about Lawyer and her friends because they seemed like real people.
Yeah, no, I agree.
With that.
That's true.
Them. That's something that I even say in the Rob Zombie one, is that since we focused so much time as Michael as a child, that by the time we got to Lori, Annie, and Linda, I didn't care about them so much. Uh-huh. Now, Annie, I did, but only because the actress she played Laurie Strode's daughter in 4 and 5.
That's the reason you cared.
So,
okay.
And I cared because I like, you know, growing up, you know, she's...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, Jamie Lloyd. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
But that's cheating because that's
it
you
is
coming
cheating.
From the future and having future knowledge in order to enjoy the first one. Like, you mentioned the good characters and everything. And I do agree with that.
Yeah.
But I also have some complaints about it. That some things that really bugged me. Like, they play up this girl as the smart girl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're expecting her to be smart and to behave in some smart way. And that's how she's going to say it. But not at all. She is an idiot when it comes to actually...
Holding the knife.
Like, everything that, oh my gosh, once you get to the, like, climax and everything, like, it just seems like she's doing things that I'm like, no human is that dumb. No one's going to not check if he's dead and then sit down right in front of him. Like, who would do that? Come on. Like, no, you go and stab cut his head off. Literally cut the head off until it is off from his body. You are not safe.
Sure. Jamie Lee Curtis said, without it, there wouldn't have been a movie. Like, if she stabbed him once and he was dead,
yeah,
there wouldn't have been a movie. She throws the knife because she thinks he's dead. And then after the closet, which she thinks he's dead again, she leaves the knife again.
Like, how many times does it take for you to learn, girl?
Apparently two. That's all it took. By the next one, I don't think she was dumb anymore, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, she's book smart, but she's not used to taking on killers.
Well, then why make her out to be smart if you're not going to use it? It's like a Chekhov's gun thing, you know, is kind of what I was expecting.
A lot of people analyze it to say some of the rules of, like, slashers, the virgin, the good girl virgin, mm-hmm. is the one that lives.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That makes sense, I suppose. Right. But you didn't need to make her smart if you're just trying to make her pure.
Sure. Yeah. I get it. But I like that she was smart.
Yeah,
because a lot of... I mean, it would have just been...
I guess it makes her more likable.
It is. It would have just been boring if she was like staring out the window in the classroom. She sees Michael and the teacher's like, hey, I asked you a question. She's like, I don't know.
I'm stupid. Yeah, you're right. No, you're right.
I like her a lot better as being smart.
Yeah. No, you're. I think that's a fair point.
Yeah. The... It's counter to Linda, who is supposed to be the airhead.
Okay.
She's the one that says totally all the time.
A foil. Yeah.
Foil, thank you. That's the term I was looking for. She's like, totally. And she's like, I forgot my geometry book. And she's like, so what?
I was forgetting my geometry book. I know. Book, I remember that.
And my English book and my math book.
And to breathe sometimes, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I liked Annie. She was kind of in the middle ground. I don't think she was unsmart. She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, Michael's just going around killing people and she was just going to get her boyfriend. Interesting scene for me is she gets to the car. It's locked. She's like, dang it, I forgot the keys. Uh-huh. She goes back in the house. She doesn't even know where the keys are at. She digs in her bag. She grabs the keys, goes back to the car. And without unlocking it, just opens the door and sits down. And then she turns right like, wait a minute. Like, it clicks for her. Like, what happened? And that's where Michael starts strangling her.
Yeah.
And then she didn't stand a chance. Like, she's honking the horn like crazy, but no one's coming to her help.
You're pointing out to me that there's some interesting writing in some of these scenes, for sure.
And it might be because I've seen it like 10 or more times in my life.
Yeah, and that's a thing about anytime, right? Anytime you watch a movie that, if it's one you haven't seen before, like what state you're in when you watch it is definitely going to affect your opinion of it. Like you could watch a movie one time and then another time and have a different experience each time. So
yeah,
I mean that could be playing a role too, but
that's true. That is true.
But also it is a 1978 movie and
right.
I am a 2023 consumer. So
yeah. I mean, it's different. If I'm watching a movie now that has come out now, it's definitely, you're gonna have a higher body count. The scares have to be scarier because we're all used to the certain same things by now.
Yeah.
Like, things that happen in here are now overdone by other movies, but it's not this movie's fault that other movies used it afterwards.
Yeah. And yet, not to pull information from the future here, but 1977 Suspiria, I did not have the same experience.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that.
Yeah, that's the next episode we're going to cover.
Which we know because we have a time machine and
we
have seen the future.
Or you got to record these together sometime.
No, shh. Don't tell them that.
Don't tell them the magic.
That's right. Don't break the magic.
Interesting things like the sheriff in here, Sheriff Lee Brackett, who's Annie's father, just a total tidbit in the remake with Rob Zombie. He's played by Brad Dourif, who's Chucky. Mm-hmm. And I was such a fan thing to do to me, like to bring in more people that I'm like, I already love him because I know him from other things. And you're right, that's cheating, but I had to bring that up too. I mean, we kind of jumped all over the place. Let's see here.
I think jumping all over the place is more fun.
I think I wrote some things that I wanted to talk about. So in this one, in that first scene when they drive up to the insane asylum, as Loomis and Chambers, there she lights a cigarette, and the matchbook she lights a cigarette with is the Red Rabbit Lounge. And it didn't click to me until I really studied the Rob Zombie ones that there's that strip club exists in the Rob Zombie movies. Like Michael Myers' mom is a stripper at that club.
Oh, interesting.
And the bullies at school have like a naked picture of his mom.
Wow.
Like an advertisement. And it's like they pulled this one little detail from this little matchbook in the car.
That's awesome.
The Red Rabbit Lounge, and made a whole story out of it.
That's really cool.
And I didn't know that until really studying the Rob Zombie ones and paying attention.
I also like that name, the Red Rabbit Lounge, because that already sounds scary. Like any other color rabbit would not be scary, but Red Rabbit Lounge definitely sounds scary to me.
Yeah.
Because like, why is the rabbit red, right? Because it's covered in blood. That's right. Why.
Another thing I find interesting with sequels is that they always talk about how Michael killed four people. But his original sister, two babysitters, and Bob.
Okay.
Which is four. But they always forget, because Loomis didn't find it when he finds where Michael stripped his clothes by that phone booth. There's a truck there, and his hospital white clothes are laying on the truck. But behind this hill or stack of trash or something, right around the corner, is a dead body that Michael killed to get his iconic suit.
Yep.
No one ever counts that in the sequels.
That's a mistake. Yeah.
Or it's just because Loomis never found the body, because it wasn't in Haddonfield, and they could have accredited it to somebody else killing him.
Oh, I guess if you can't prove something, you can't say someone did it, even if everybody knows, right?
Right.
Like, yeah.
which I think is interesting. Also with the commentary, what I found interesting is if they're setting up this Halloween, and then the way they describe it, back in the late 70s, people didn't go crazy decorating their houses with Halloween decorations. Mm-hmm. You just saw kids walking around with costumes, with jack-o'-lanterns, and they're like, oh, it's Halloween night. But it wasn't the fall when they filmed it. And to fake it, they got a bunch of leaves and painted them colors, carried them around in trash bags. And every time Lori was like walking, they were throwing them out with fans and having them blow because it was windy out, but they were having them blow in her direction.
That's really
and
funny.
What really, you can't unsee it once you see it, is that she's sitting down on this pillar waiting for Annie to drive up. And on her side of the road, there's leaves everywhere. When Annie pulls up on the other side of the road, zero leaves because it's not fall.
Yeah, that's funny.
I thought that was pretty interesting. Also, Donald Pleasance, who you mentioned, you know, as, you know, being Hammond over the top, he was only there to film for 4 days. He filmed his whole thing. And the whole movie itself was 21 days of shooting, which feels like fast to me.
I think. Yeah, very.
That's super quick. But they didn't have a lot of, like, it was, like, had a really small budget. And most... And
it was a simple movie, I would say.
Right. You know? What I one detail I love so much is that the cars in this movie are all owned by the crew. Like...
Oh, wow.
Like, because they didn't have the budget to go rent cars for the movie.
I see.
So John Carpenter's car is the car that is owned by Laurie Strode's dad. It's got the little, like, Strode Realty on the side of it. And then... Same thing when they're driving to that grave site to find that Michael Myers' older sister's grave has gone missing. That car was another crew member's car. They just borrowed other people's cars so they can put them in the set without,
that's neat.
Without being there.
What is that noise?
I don't know. Huh. Are you haunted? No. Other than that, I know you haven't seen any others but this one, right?
Right. I've only seen this one so far.
So the timeline, I just kind of want to go over the timeline for you so you understand. Like,
okay.
Part 1 and 2 came out. And so he originally didn't, John Carpenter, he ended it with Michael Myers disappearing, not because he wanted a part 2, but because he thought you can't kill the boogeyman.
Oh, like,
it's not possible to kill the boogeyman. And he wanted Halloween to be an anthology series where every movie was a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And the company was like, no, it made too much money. You need to bring Michael back.
Ah.
And if you don't come back to direct it, we're going to do without you.
Oh.
So he came back to part 2. It's mostly takes place in a hospital, which most part 2s in this, every time there's another part 2, I say in quotes, even though it's a long series, they find a way to make a lot of it in the hospital, which is interesting. After that, he's like, fine, I got to finally do my anthology. But it already was in people's mind that each Halloween movie is going to be about Michael Myers. So the third one, which I really love and has now become a cult, like following, people love this movie, had nothing to do with Michael Myers. It was about this company that was making evil masks that were designed to kill children for Halloween. So that's its own reality.
So was that not popular then because it didn't have Michael Myers? Were they right?
They were correct, yeah. But but I think that if they would have come out with the anthology idea right off the bat, then people wouldn't have expected it to be Michael again.
Sure, that's fair.
Because if they came out with a movie just called Halloween Season of the Witch,
yeah,
then they would have been like, oh, this is another John Carpenter movie. But according to the preview, Michael's not in this. I might enjoy this. I like John Carpenter.
Yeah, yeah.
So it didn't do well. And after it didn't do well, they just made the subsequent next 3 a continuous storyline. Jamie Lee Curtis didn't come back. They have her daughter play a character for 4, 5, and 6. Paul Rudd is in part 6. It gets really crazy with this whole cult that worships and follows Michael Myers. There's witchcraft involved.
That sounds like the Halloween fan base, pretty much.
Yeah. After 6, they do like a Superman Returns. They say only part 1 and 2 are canon anymore.
Oh, no.
We're going to bring Jamie back 20 years after the original night. Because part 2 is the same night as part 1. And I liked H2O a lot. You could
also say pulled a Highlander, you know.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I like Halloween H2O a lot. It was really good. It was followed up by Halloween Resurrection, which was really bad. But it was so bad it's good to me.
I have to ask this.
Cheesy. Yeah.
Was Halloween H2O, was it aquatic in nature? Is it about water or
ocean? No, it stands for Halloween 20 years later.
I know, but you got to make it, like, you know, take place somehow in something to do with the ocean.
I'm trying to think of anything that was, I mean, no, I can't think of anything water related.
Rip.
I mean, it's like at a college.
Missed opportunity.
Laurie Strode's changed her name. She's a professor at this college. She has a kid who doesn't even know her past with Michael Myers. They got brought a lot of pretty teens in it because, you know, they had to, you know, make it young again. But in this reality, part 1 and 2 happened. It's 20 years later. I enjoyed that one a lot. Then the next one happened. A lot of people hate it. It's called Resurrection. It was like a reality show. Busta Rhymes and Tyra Banks are playing characters who want to make a reality show about surviving a night in the Michael Myers' house. house. Busta Rhymes wants to dress up as Michael Myers and scare people, but he doesn't know that Michael's really going around killing people.
Okay.
That one did so poorly. That's when Rob Zombie gets the ability to do his Rob Zombie 1 and 2, which he didn't even want to do a part 2. But they told him, we're either going to do it with or without you. So he wanted to make sure no one ruined his vision.
Rob Zombie should have just done zombie movies, right? I mean, logically, based on his name.
I mean, he did House of a Thousand Corpses. he definitely has a style of the way he does horror movies, but he does a lot of horror movies. And then, so that's the timeline of itself. Then after that, we wait a significant amount of time, 9 years, I think, after Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 till we get Halloween 2018, which is a new part 2. They erased everything in the existence except for part 1. They continue part 1 40 years later this time, and then we get a trilogy to finish it off, and that's the last timeline that currently exists of 13 films.
Surprised they didn't call it H18. Seems about as logical as anything
else. Well, no, they could have called it H40 because it was 40 years later.
Oh, okay.
1978 to 2018, they could have called it H40, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That doesn't make any chemical sense.
Anything else to say about the movie?
There's no way you can put 4 hydrogens on an oxygen, you know?
I don't know. Can we not?
There's no way. Yeah.
I don't think so. Oh, because there's not enough to hold on to.
Because the oxygen doesn't have enough valence electrons, I don't think. Just saying.
I get you. All right. Okay. All right. So that's what Jesse and I thought of the movie. I love the movie. Jesse maybe didn't like the movie as much. I try to convince him of all the great parts of it. I think he saw some of it. But what do you think? Are there more people out there that don't think this movie, you know, it's always number one on people's list of best horror movies ever? And I love it a lot. But if there's more people out there that either do love it or don't love it, tell me why you love it. Reach out to us. But next, we're going to have our segment on Suspiria. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Nightmare Echoes podcast. I'm your host, Elzar. I'm joined by co-host Jesse.
Hello.
What are we talking about today?
Today, we are talking about Suspiria.
Yeah, I'm a fan. My kids are all in dance, so I thought, hey, you know, dance horror, maybe something I can get them interested in to watch, too. You know, I was excited to see this. The 1977 one didn't really cover the dancing that much.
It did not. I was a big fan of it. I actually loved that movie, Suspiria 1977. It was fantastic.
Yeah, Dario Argento, written by him and his new wife, Daria Nicolito. I said that completely wrong. I love a lot about it. First thing I love about it is the music.
Yes.
Like the awesome music by Goblin, it was pog rock.
Incredible. Yeah. And if I can contrast it against Halloween, to me, this was more what it also had a recognizable, you know, sort of high-pitched sort of theme. But, oh, man, it had so much more going on. It was fully instrumented. All the instruments were interesting. They all fit together. It was varied throughout the movie. There was lots of different music, and it changed.
Interesting. They wrote the whole score before the movie was filmed.
That is fascinating.
We're going to make a film around the score.
that is awesome. They did a phenomenal job. I was really impressed by the score. I really enjoyed the score. To me, actually, it was score and visuals.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was score and visuals.
The colors are insane.
Like, the story was okay, but it was the score and the visuals.
It's not plot heavy.
Yeah, it's not.
The remake was plot heavy.
It certainly was.
But colorful.
It was the opposite. It was the opposite movie. It had no music, no visuals, and was just plot.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I'm just thinking, okay, so you were inspired by a movie, and you decided to make the opposite movie.
Yeah.
How does that work?
I don't know, but he made it an hour longer, I like the story he put there. He cheats a little bit by pulling from the two other movies that Argento did in this, what they call a trilogy of the three mothers.
Yeah. I would love to see the other two mothers by Argento.
Yeah, I haven't seen them yet either. I need to. Yeah, if I had all the time in the world, I would have totally done it before this. Yeah. I thought I should definitely see the remake before I record this, so at least I have the knowledge that it exists. I guess I want to talk about like the different deaths, you know?
Oh,
like,
okay.
So Pat runs away from that school when Susie first walks up. She doesn't know what she's doing. She's running in the rain.
Yeah.
She gets to her friend's.
Wonderful dramatic scene.
Oh, yeah. I mean, super colorful.
And the rain, but I mean, just the rain, it adds to the tension so much.
Right. I took a lot of pictures in the movie
because of all the pictures of the movie?
Because of the colors. Of the colors.
You just do screenshots.
But I was watching it on my Blu-ray player.
Oh, okay.
Right? I know, that's old technology, right?
It is.
Physical media. So I pulled out my cell phone and took pictures of it. I love the building itself. It's beautiful.
Like, it is unbelievable.
The apartment that she stays in. With like the fish and the dove pattern, like, yeah. That's M.C. Escher, right?
I'm not sure. Okay. But I just, every building in that, the buildings were so unbelievable. I just like could not believe those buildings really existed, you know, like right. So amazing.
And there's this stained glass window on the ceiling that just has all these colors, like it's like a flower pattern almost. And it goes from dark blue to red to orange to dark yellow to yellow, mm-hmm. going outward. And when she breaks through, it's like done so well. And then she's tied around her arms are tied with the rope. And then when her body hits, it snags the rope. So it catches, it tightens around her neck, mm-hmm. and kills her. And then meanwhile, the debris that fell from the crash kills her friends whose apartment she was staying in. And just goes right through her, which was Sonia.
It was also interesting, the scene where they're pulling her face against the window.
Sure.
And pull it until it breaks through. Like, that's a very... What a forceful and dramatic way to kill someone.
Right? Oh, and the eyes were creepy out the window. Like, yeah. She's trying to look. Do I see something? All of a sudden, his eyes open. Like, yeah. What? That's right in front of me.
Just for an instant. Yep.
Yeah. I was like, what the heck? That was pretty creepy.
Talking about the colors, like the colors obviously jumped out, mm-hmm. for me as well. And I did some research on it because I was curious about it. Right. And
yeah.
Apparently it was one of the very last movies to be filmed in Technicolor.
So I read that that's actually not completely true.
Oh, really?
That they didn't film it in Technicolor, but when they processed it, with the Technicolor machine.
I see. They processed it in Technicolor. Right.
And what has led to the confusion on this is that when they did a documentary talking about the Technicolor, the displays on there didn't take out the part where you film it in Technicolor, even though they just processed it in Technicolor, uh-huh. from the slides that they were running. So it went to people being like, look, it was filmed in Technicolor. Huh. But I did read that. I was like, this is interesting.
It is interesting. Like, it's an interesting directorial choice, right? To say, like, I want the colors to pop, so let's use an old form of processing that distorts the colors, right? Like,
yeah.
Because, I mean, beautiful. If you look at The Wizard of Oz or something, like, it's so, so colorful, right? And it's just totally taking that a different direction.
Yeah, there's a scene where Sarah, her friend at dance school, is... You know, she can't wake her up. She's trying to be like, hey, we were counting the footsteps. We want to know where they're going. And she goes out. She can't get her in her room. She's following and she's being chased. Like, though she hasn't seen anything yet, she's scared. And when she's running, like the green in this scene right here,
yeah.
is so reminding me of the Emerald City.
Oh,
like I typed in my notes, like what you brought up, Wizard of Oz.
Uh-huh.
Like that green, like that's Wicked Witch of the West. So like it's filmed so well. The guy that she goes to for help wears that very interesting choice of like lime green jacket.
Yep.
Which I thought was beautiful, well, too.
I thought it was neat because, like, obviously the movie centers on red. Everything's red. But but that just makes it more striking when there's moments of green or blue.
Oh, there was some blue.
There was some blue. Absolutely was.
There's the scene where they're swimming in a pool. I don't know why, but Susie wears a t-shirt instead of a swimsuit. or bathing suit, whatever. It's just interesting. Dario Argento had them move as little as possible so that the water could be as still as possible to just add to the eeriness and spookiness.
I see.
I just thought it was really cool. But yeah, those colors are beautiful. There's one shot too. He gets all the three, red, green, and blue. It's like Sarah's left the room. Susie's there asleep in the room, and you pan to the other wall. And there is, he gets all three, red, blue, and green.
See, I interpret frame. That light over the door as being more white.
Yeah?
It looks white to me. I mean, it's got very slight bluish.
All right. I thought it was blue. But yeah, there's definitely some blue scenes in there too, though.
Yeah.
But I liked it a lot. Yeah, that music is so good.
It was awesome. I had to look up the band. I had to look up Goblin and like listen to some more of their stuff.
They're used in 1978's Dawn of the Dead.
One
where they're in a mall. If you can go anywhere at the zombie apocalypse, like hide in a mall that has everything. This mall has everything. It was beautiful. It's a good one. I watched the 2.5 hour version. There's different cuts throughout the world, and like someone put all of them together to make a 2.5 hour movie.
Weird.
I think that was done just so you could get more Goblin music in it. Which is interesting. What did you think of the magic use in the movie?
Well, there wasn't much. And that was something that kind of bothered me. I actually thought the plot was really weak, to be honest.
Sure.
But I mean, again, the music and visuals were so good, I don't care. But right. The plot was weak and didn't make a lot of sense to me, actually. But
sure.
One of the things that I did notice was I'm like, it's a movie about witches and there's no magic, like, which is not quite true. There's a little bit. It's mostly they go around stabbing people, right? Which is not magic.
Well, when Daniel dies, he's the piano player with the dog, right?
Yeah. Well, okay. Yes. That one seems probably magical.
If you're watching the shadows in the, because he looks like he's in this big square area. Like with right. massive, yeah, yeah, beautiful yeah. architecture. You look at the shadows that are moving in the background.
Yeah.
It looks like witches on a broom.
Sure.
And like they're flying around him. And then they do have a shot where it looks like they fly right over him. But we don't see it. We see from like their point of view.
So my complaint is just like, they could just as easily have walked up to him with a knife and stabbed him.
Sure.
And that wouldn't have been any less dangerous. And, you know, like they didn't use the magic to make the murders more scary. It was just unnecessary in most of the cases.
Well, okay, so there's a part of the movie where he talks about the whole point of witches.
I know, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. So there's actually, let me also just say one more thing.
Sure.
There's a scene at the end where they're all like, the American girl must die. I'm like, you're feeding her all her food and drinks. It would be totally trivial for you to poison her.
Yeah, they mentioned that she didn't eat anything that night, though.
Well, but she'd been eating stuff the whole time. If they wanted her dead, she would have been dead.
Yeah, I mean, they've been drugging her, right?
Right, but you could just give her something poisonous and kill her.
Yeah.
Like, if you want her dead, like, there's no reason for it to be this big. Oh, we can't figure out how to kill the American. What are you? She's not invincible.
Yeah.
She's a helpless girl. You have total control over her. You could have killed her anytime, a dozen different ways without magic.
But I think they want to prolong her suffering, right?
I don't know.
I think, like, there's...
Even that they could have done without any magic. And maybe they did. I'm not sure magic was... I mean, it was barely involved. You know what I mean? Like, it just... It just seems like they didn't use the magic to do anything that wouldn't have been easier to do under the circumstances the normal way.
Sure. I like the way that Professor Millis, like, he has a quote that about witches, like their whole point, which is like, they're maleficent, negative, and destructive. Their knowledge of the art of the occult gives them tremendous powers. They can change the course of events in people's lives, but only to do harm. The goal is to accumulate great personal wealth. It can only be achieved by injury to others. They can cause suffering, sickness, and even death to those who, for whatever reason, have offended them.
But how does killing her get them money?
I don't get that either. And they didn't seem very powerful.
They
like
really
only
didn't.
Helena Marcos.
Right. And
had she, power.
She didn't seem that powerful either. All she could do is turn invisible.
Well, she was.
And not I even mean, that
and,
invisible.
And live for a long time.
Okay. Well, that's a big one. I got it.
Yeah,
that's a big one.
But apparently she had come up with a bunch of wealth.
Yeah.
So, but I think just owning a dance school on its own, I mean, dance classes are expensive. I know I have 3 kids in dance.
Well, yeah, but that's not magical.
That's, yeah, it's not.
That's like just you could being have done good at
that.
Dance.
You could have done that without.
Yeah.
Without all that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why it made no sense to me. I'm just like, wow.
I did like the backstory of Helena Marcos. Like, we thought, you know, they tell you she founded a school for the occult and dance. Like, what a concept. And then after she's killed, okay, we'll drop the occult part.
Yeah,
can we still
really
have
funny.
Our dance academy?
That's
she's
really
referred to in this movie as the Black Queen. In other movies, the mother of something.
It just kind of seems like we are the Academy of Torture, Mayhem, Death, and Origami. You know, like it just seems kind of very, you know, strange.
An origami.
It's
that's funny.
But they did do a really great job, I think, of using that to build atmosphere. I mean, I didn't even think really about the illogical aspects of the plot
either.
Until after I finished
it
watching
it. It was Mother of Size. I just wanted to say that.
Oh, yeah, I know. Suspiriorum is
right.
Of size.
Got it. Yeah, no, never during this movie did I think, this plot isn't working for me.
Yeah, I know.
Like, it was so well done. It's kind of like Phantasm.
Mm-hmm.
I think the plot gets a little weird. I don't know when it's a dream and when it's not a dream.
Yeah.
And by the end, I'm like, wait, what happened? It didn't bother me enough because I like the music in that one, not as much as this one.
It's an experience, right?
It was fun.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's, in a way, it's a good thing that the plot was kind of messed up and artistic because, like, you look at the 2018 Suspiria, which is a totally different movie.
Yeah.
And that movie, it made too much sense and they showed you too much and they explained too much.
I like the use of magic, though.
They certainly used a lot of, I actually did, I liked the idea of dance being a way to do magic. That was cool.
They touch Susie's feet and hands.
Yeah.
And Olga, who was just in the 77, was the woman she stayed at her apartment for that one night while she needed it. And this one is like trying to leave the academy and they use Susie's dance to like torture her,
yeah,
slam
I know.
Her against walls and and stuff.
And well, and then later they imply that Susie must have been at some level aware of what she was supposed to do, like, because she did it too well.
Sure.
And
yeah.
And of course, then at the very end of the movie, we find out, well, that was clearly true, you know?
Yes.
And like, she clearly knew exactly what she was
that
doing.
That was a good twist. I did not see that coming.
Neither did I.
Interesting side, though, the woman who played Olga, who was getting tortured and twisted, is a contortionist.
Oh, that's
awesome.
So
it didn't harm her
right. To
do the scene.
It was a wonderfully done scene. It was very graphic. And they did a great job of making it horrific, you know?
Yeah, like, completely. At the end of the 2018, they did show a lot.
Not just at the end. They showed everything at the beginning.
Oh, okay. When they're stabbing through the body and stuff.
I felt like there was no mystery. They show Helena Marcus, I think, right from the beginning.
Yeah.
They show everybody being casually witches and talking about it and everything and openly. And there's no... 1977 Suspiria is drenched in mystery.
Sure.
Like, you don't know what's going on. They never even show you Marcus, you know?
Yeah.
Like, in fact, the whole movie, they don't really ever show you her clearly.
You know she's uncredited, right?
Interesting. I did not.
It is, according to one of the actors, Dario Argento got a 90-year-old woman who used to be a prostitute off the street.
Wow.
And asked her to play the part in the movie.
Interesting.
And she's not credited.
That is quite interesting. They never show you anything. They never explain anything.
Okay.
And in the second one, they explain everything right off the bat.
Okay. So one detail about all that, though. Tilda Swinton, the one that was the teacher that touched her feet and her hands for the dance, was also the old man doctor and was also Helena Marcos.
Was also the...
She played all three of those characters.
Wait, the old man doctor? Wait, what are we...
The old man that Patricia goes to at the very beginning of the movie to say, I think there's witches here, and he's investigating.
Wait, he's a girl?
Yeah, he's Tilda Swinton, the dance instructor. It's the same actress.
What?
Right, and then Helena Marcos is the same actress. She played three roles in this movie.
And one of them was a male, and totally
one of them was a very believable old man.
I had no idea.
Yeah,
that
like
is
it
shocking.
Blew my mind how, like, she did good in this.
That is insane. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, that is crazy.
I wonder if that's supposed to have some meaning.
I don't know, other than, like, man, she did a good job.
The 2018 one, like I said, I felt like they fed us too much. And then I kind of felt like they made the main character way too overpowered and turned her into kind of a Mary Sue author insert a little bit at the end. And I was a little like, there are a lot of aspects of it I liked. And I just, but the fundamental problem I felt was didn't feel artistic because like.
Even with all the dance?
Even with all, so like, you know, my old complaint about which there was a reviewer on the internet who was talking about Phantom Menace and why it's not as good as the original Star Wars trilogy, right?
Because he's old.
And he's like, he gives an example. He's like, all you need to do to see that the writing is not as good is ask, you know, describe Han Solo, describe Princess Leia, describe Luke Skywalker, right? And you just, and it, you can describe each of these characters in detail. Like they're specific. Specific people. And then you say, okay, now describe Qui-Gon Jinn. Describe, you know, you go through the characters. In Phantom, I don't know. I don't
think
they have personalities.
Is it because I'm a nerd? Oh, you don't think it's a personality?
I don't think they have personality. I don't think they have characters at all.
I think if I'm going to go to Qui-Gon, it's hilarious because he's like, claims he's going to free Anakin, but now you have to call me master. I don't know.
I don't feel like he has a personality. It's...
Really?
It just feels... I think he's right. I think the characters in that movie are all blank. And I felt that way a little bit about Suspiria 2018. The characters felt blank to me. I didn't feel like they had personalities. Whereas in 1977, when they had very distinctive personalities.
Sure. I guess I liked Patricia 2018 when she was very terrified. When she went to go see the doctor at the very beginning, she was terrified and it was a believable terrified. And then Sarah,
Sarah is like, in the original, she's like manic and paranoid and...
Okay, I guess I like Sarah in the new one after the magic has affected her, when she's almost like zombie-like dancing, when they like already broken her bone, then forced her to dance anyway.
Which is...
She's kind of like undead.
Again, not having a character, not having a personality, right? You're a zombie.
This is interesting. Maybe I do like zombie movies. I'm totally clear on this.
I just think they didn't do a good job developing the characters in the 2018 one. I didn't really like the 2018 one very much.
Yeah.
Just not a big fan.
Okay.
I gotta say. But they did do some things that were neat. Like you said, the dancing.
I like Mia Goth. Maybe that's what it is.
Oh, what?
Oh, sorry. Sarah's played by Mia Goth.
Oh.
She's in X and Pearl.
I thought you were saying, I like Mia Goth, you know?
Mia Goth. Yeah. I like myself a goth woman. Yeah.
That's right. That's what I thought you were saying.
Mia Goth. Yeah, she's in this movie called X, which takes place in the late 70s in Texas. And they rented a farmhouse. They didn't tell the people they're there to shoot a porno.
Uh-huh.
and the people start, all that are involved in the porno start slowly dying. Just like this movie, in that movie, Mia Goth plays herself as a young porn star.
I see.
And plays the old woman. And the makeup's so well that you have no idea until you see the credits that she played both of them. Which was really interesting when that movie ended in the theaters. After the credits rolled, they showed you a preview for Pearl, which was the name of the old woman. And they at the same time secretly filmed a second film while doing the first film, because they had the same farmhouse. Uh-huh. And they just filmed a second film at the same time, and they were like, we'll release it in a few months.
Huh.
And I'm like, it's already ready. I'm like, what?
Wow.
So it's good. So Mia Goth's in that, and I like her a lot. So maybe that's why I like Sarah. I think it helps if I know the actor sometimes.
Yeah, no, I think I liked the Sarah in the original one better, because she seemed neurotic and, I don't know, relatable.
I like the Miss Tanner in the first one, in the 1978 one, a lot. She had that smile that never went away. Even when she was yelling at Daniel, she's like, be gone, be gone. But she's like, the smile never stopped. She was upset that her nephew was bitten by a dog, but smiled the entire time. Like,
I didn't notice that.
I gotcha. Get out of my school. Like,
I didn't notice that. I didn't notice that. But it was a very dramatic scene with the dog and the blind, like, whatever.
I didn't get why Albert would have provoked the dog or what. I don't know. They needed to get rid of him.
I don't know what the story was there. That's, again, another thing where they were just mysterious.
Right. But apparently ruining people's lives is supposed to make them more powerful. Even though I never saw it happen. Maybe that's what all this is. They're like ruining Daniel's life before they kill him is like playing with their food before they eat it.
Yeah. You're just saying somehow the whole, they gain wealth and power by ruining people's lives. Like maybe that just means they do that directly. Like it's not through some means, but literally just the fact that someone is hurt somehow causes them to become more powerful directly or something.
That
like,
could be. That could
maybe
be.
That's what it is. If so, it is kind of surprising people keep going there, you know.
To this dance academy?
Yeah. Although I guess they can magic away people's suspicions.
Right. Well, I think they generally only go after one girl at a time.
Yeah.
I think they're trying to torture just Susie in the original one.
Yeah.
And then in the remake, they talk about how Tilda Swinton's character talks about how it's too soon to go after another person. Like they just lost somebody. Are we sure we need to do it? But it had a different angle when it wasn't power they were going after. They were trying to train her to get Helena Marcus's essence into her, a new younger body, so she could continue to live forever.
Yeah. You're talking about the new movie. Yeah.
Right. The new movie. Right. Which is different. Like they gave us a story. Like you said, they overgave us a story.
I didn't quite understand like why at the end, suddenly we're supposed to hate everyone who sided with Marcos or whatever. I guess they didn't get me on board with that one. I didn't understand why we liked one lady and hated the other one. That wasn't fleshed out for me.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that, well, Susie is our main character, and I guess I liked her, you know, because I'm supposed to, so that when we find out that she's has been this all-powerful witch, she just may not have known it the whole time, but she was always called to be there. Like, as an early child, she was always called to join this dance company.
Right.
It's because whenever she was reincarnated, it like hid away her memories until she's old enough to get it. And she slowly starts to get it. I think by the time it revealed it, I was happy that it wasn't Helena Marcus that got it. And it was Susie that apparently was really the powerful person. I like the end.
Sure, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about
everybody that died.
Everyone that back when there was a
vote.
There was a lot of the whole internal division. It was between Helena Marcos and Blanc, Madame Blanc.
Okay, Madame.
Yeah, so we have the Blanc faction and the Marcos faction.
When they're voting, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd never understood the basis of that rivalry, I guess.
Yeah.
And if they were trying to portray one as a good guy and the other as a bad guy, they failed to me. I never picked up on that. And at the end, it's like she punishes all the pro-Marcos faction by killing them, right? And rewards all the pro-Blanc faction. That did nothing for me because I didn't understand why we would prefer one over the other. I don't understand that at all. I wasn't on board.
But you didn't have a problem with Susie getting all the power. It's just that other detail that was bothering you.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the big climactic scene where it's like, now we punish the wrongdoers and reward the good people. And I was like, wait, are those the wrongdoers and those the good people? Why do you say that?
Right, okay. I can get you. I like that after getting the power, Susie's character goes and gives the old man what he's always been looking for, which is the answer what happened to his wife.
Yeah.
That was nice of her.
It was. I felt like there were moments in that whole epilogue that were a little bit preachy and weird, and I was like, okay.
She's a good witch.
She's
a witch, but she's a good witch.
I mean, I felt like they're trying to make her the goddess of feminism or something, and I don't know. I just got a strange vibe.
Okay, but maybe they were and I didn't notice.
Well, maybe I'm hallucinating too, because I whenever a character suddenly becomes all powerful and starts saying things like, you know, she said something about such and such people should be punished or whatever, these people should be happy and these people, like, whenever you, sure. Like, it starts to feel so, like, author insert-y.
Okay, and I guess it's the problem that I've seen the original one multiple times now. Yeah. And I've only seen the new one once. It doesn't help that it's 2.5 hours.
Yeah, it's too long.
It's hard to do another sitting.
Yeah.
One thing I found interesting that the new one did that I was hoping in the original is that you had all these people that spoke all these different languages in the original, but all we got to hear was this dubbed English. Because it was, when it was filmed, they didn't record the audio.
Mm-hmm.
Because one person was speaking German and one person was speaking Italian, and they didn't, some actors in the same scenes didn't know what the other actor was saying.
Yeah.
There's a documented case where, or case, whatever, with a document, like where one actor was done with his line, he would kick Susie in the shin.
Wow.
So she knew it was her time to speak since she didn't understand German.
Right.
The director has gone on record to say that he's sad that no one will ever get to hear her original voice in the movie because he liked the actor's original voice, Jessica Harper.
Well, but that back then it was pretty common to redub all the lines in the studio.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that I do love that original movie, in this new movie we do get to hear a lot of different languages, because if the school's in Europe,
that's true, you're right,
it's that one thing I liked.
I do like that, I agree.
It was fun. Maybe when I was young, I watched everything with subtitles. Uh-huh. Like, I used to be a snob about it. Like, you can't watch anime dub. Yeah. What is your problem?
I agree, that's a neat thing about it, that they had all the different languages and stuff. Yeah. There's a number of things I liked about it. I definitely didn't like it the way I liked this 1977 one.
Oh, one thing about the original, the death of Sarah, when she falls into the barbed wire, there's a close up and you can tell it's not barbed, or is it
razor sharp? I noticed.
But the actress said it kept pinching her skin. Uh-huh. And so it was really painful for her to film it anyway. No. So she wasn't faking it if she was acting painful, because she was stuck in this wire that really hurt her.
Well, that's interesting.
I'm looking forward to watching the other two of this trilogy.
Yeah, the barbed wire was a pretty cool trap, because it's just so, like, that is a pretty painful.
Let's lock you in a room and make you go through this small window. You're going to figure it out eventually. Yeah, that lock was silly. He had this blade.
Oh, I know.
To pick the lock, and I can't figure it out.
I didn't understand.
I can't figure it out. Dumb. It's like, I would have had it like that.
Right. Yeah. I thought that the way I had to explain it away in my head was like, there was something that he couldn't move. That, like, there was something in the door that he couldn't move it up far enough, so he was having to try to use the tip of the.
So we at work in one of the bathroom stalls, the one closest to where I work, they used to have one of the little sliding locks, but it broke off. Uh-huh. So they added a lock like that. All you do is spin it over.
Yeah.
Anybody can just get their badge and tip it up and unlock it. It's so frustrating, because we were all shaking the door. I'm like, I'm in here. Like, it reminds you of that lock.
And
so easy.
And it just spent so much time trying to get that. that scene is really long too.
All right, anything else you want to say about it?
The 1977 one. Yeah, there were so many cool scenes. Like you said, they didn't do much dancing.
They didn't do much dancing. The maggot scene.
Oh, yeah.
That was gross.
The maggot scene was, it was gross, but the thing that I kept wondering is why it happened, whether they did it on purpose to get them all in the same room.
There's two things, I think. One, it's a way to make everybody have a little bit of terror, which adds to their, people's lives are miserable, so we get more power, even if it's like a small scare for one night. But then they do put them all in one room and then put Helena Marcos next to them. So I don't know if it's like feeding off of that somehow. It makes her stronger somehow. Yeah, I was wondering
why she was there and what that was about.
I think she was trying to somehow breathe in their essence or something.
It
reminded me of Revenge of the Nerds. They're all sleeping in the dorm room. Or the basketball gym.
Another thing, like, that I thought, the original Helena Marcos, that snore was scary.
It was scary.
That was a creep. And then the new Helena Marcos in the 2018 was not that scary. Right. In my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was a scary snore for sure.